Hello and welcome to the Maine Reader on Maine Airs, a service of the Iris Network. My name is Randy Labar. I am reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. Copyright 2005 by Hannah Holmes and published by Bloomsbury Publishing, New York, New York. In the last episode, the author had begun to study the insects in her lawn, including the mosquitoes who carry the West Nile virus. We resume with episode 4 of Suburban Safari on page 34. It's deadly dry August by the time Chuck and some fellow bug hunters from the Maine Entomological Society congregate in my yard. The first question I ask the president and state entomologist, Dick Dearborn, is how my yard differs from a natural area. He squints at the lawn through his glasses. His T-shirt is crossed by the band of an army surplus collecting bag, and by the suspenders that hold up his green work pants. Sunlight glares off his head. "I don't find this unnatural," he counters. "You've got a variety of habitats in a limited range. You've got pollen sources, nectar sources. You've got everything from wet to dry, vegetated to non-vegetated. That lawn, to an insect, is a grassland. Your trees are a forest. I don't think they notice the difference between urban and rural settings." Although I haven't thought of it this way, I have discovered that different insects travel different parts of the yard. On one of his mosquito-trapping visits, Chuck had told me how to make pitfall traps, promising they would reveal a hidden world of creepy crawlies. Until then, the state of the art for my insect study program had been to lie on a chaise lounge and stare at the ground. This amused the neighbors. "Hey," I heard neighbor Hugh stage marvel from his side of the lilac hedge one afternoon, "here is an orange cankamangus bug." I stifled a giggle. "Well," he yelled in mock amazement, "an Ethiopian mite." Also, from my chaise time, I had realized that, from the perspective of a crawling insect, my yard must constitute a vast nation. For many of them, crossing from one side to the other must require a Lewis and Clark-size ambition. One day I watched the struggles of a single brown ant. The ant had a tiny prize clenched in her mandibles, and this greatly complicated her journey. Like their relatives the bees and the wasps, ants are predominantly female. Males are produced rarely, and for just one purpose. They typically have big eyes for locating virgin queens and fast wings for catching them. As the ant attempted to squeeze between two blades of grass, her prize jammed. She backed and tried again. Then she reversed and retraced her path for about 3 minutes, covering 2 inches. She turned and tried another route. To her, the grass blades were as big as fallen trees tangled by a tornado. She struggled over and around and through them. In 20 minutes, she progressed 6 inches. I tried to clear a path for her with a twig, but this frightened her into dropping the food. She spent 5 minutes hunting for it. A rice-sized black beetle trundled by her in the fallen forest. 2 large black ants passed. A gnat, a fraction of my aunt's size, ascended a blade of grass, paused, and then spread its wings. A wee wind blew the gnat 4 inches sideways where it crashed into the grass. It climbed another blade and flew another 4 inches. This is an enjoyable way to spend summer hours. However, many teeny beings are nocturnal, and I found night work to be chilly and fraught with skunks. So at Chuck's behest, I ran a trap line. I dug 4 holes in different states of my backyard nation, one in the shady state of dead leaves, one in shady grass, one in sunny grass, and one in sunny garden. Into each hole I plunked a plastic cup holding 1 inch of rubbing alcohol. Sorry, bugs. The next morning I emptied the sunny grass cup onto a paper towel and slid it under my microscope. It was mobbed with ants, 19 of them. There were also an earwig, 3 small spiders, a black beetle, and a tiny fly. The beetle appeared to have crustaceans, probably harmless hitchhikers, Dick Dearborn told me later, glued to its wing covers. I shifted the paper towel, scanning clods of dirt that had tumbled in with my subjects. The ant's eyes were enormous and almond-shaped. The earwig's pincers looked ferocious. A gust of wind lifted the paper towel toward the lens of the microscope, and as pincers and hairs and bulging eyes came at me through the eyepiece, I squealed and fell off the back of my stool. Unfortunately, this would become something of a theme, and I would do it most often in the presence of impressionable young girls. After showing one girl around the yard, I picked up a rice cake from the ground, and, spying 20 ants on its flip side, shrieked and flung the rice cake. After showing another girl how sparkly and gooey flowers are under the microscope, I picked up a dead black beetle to show her. On my palm, the beetle vibrated. I yelled and pitched it away. My squealy tendencies have been hard to dampen. My next pitfall trap, the garden, introduced me to that bane of pitfall trappers, the slug. 2 leopard-spotted, inch-long specimens had fallen in and turned to latex. Everything else that fell in had stuck to them. I could discern 1 sow bug. I slung the whole mess into the bushes. Shady grass was also slugified, though not as badly. When I slid this batch under the scope, I discovered a herd of baby sow bugs, nearly cute in their pale teensiness. But dead leaves was best. A half-inch beetle with a metallic green head and shoulders shone like a Christmas ornament. Butterflies don't come any prettier. There were also 2 earwigs and a small red-eyed surprise. Fruit flies, I wrote in my notes, are wild animals. As the days passed, the trap line revealed a pattern. The sunniest cups reaped drought-hardy ants and spiders. Sow bugs and slugs I caught only in the shady sites. During the day, slugs cower under the dead leaves and detritus to stay moist. Sometimes I would see them at dawn, finishing a meal of dandelion bud, or sliding toward the bamboo wilderness. As for the sow bugs, I learned that they evolved from sea creatures, and although they have come ashore, haven't yet evolved an alternative to gills. To breathe, they have to stay damp. Beetles also turned up in the shady states, perhaps because that's where the food is, or maybe because they're poor at shedding heat. Now, with the society here to comb my yard, the drought has become severe. Dick kneels in shady grass and unfolds a yellow pillowcase. He pulls a tulip bulb planter from his bag and grinds it into the soil. He dumps a plug of soil on the pillowcase. Very dry. He spreads the powder, looking for motion. Very, very dry. There should be root weevils, thrips, chinch bugs. He tears roots from the plug. Nothing moves. He brushes an acorn from under his elbow. You've probably got acorn weevils, he says hopefully. Across the lawn we go, digging plugs, but the result is the same. Not even any thrips on the clover, and the worms must be down to China. Chuck Peters, a high school science teacher, joins us, holding out a shiny brown fragment. This is a piece of a click bug, he says. Is this a root weevil thing? Someone else asks. Chuck Peters drops his beetle bit. You know we're desperate when we're looking at parts. But as they fan out across the insect nation, the bug hunters discover that not every state is equally depopulated by drought. Look at all that life, Chuck Peters breathes, lifting the lid of the compost bin. The oasis of my vegetable scraps is churning with sow bugs. A little later, he hails me from behind the raspberries. He pushes aside a wad of straw mulch and starts grabbing at things. This microhabitat is just teeming with life. He pinches up a narrow rove beetle and tucks it into a vial to preserve it. Rove beetles bite, but a bug hunter doesn't care. A centipede rumbles across the exposed earth and dives into the mulch. Chuck pokes it. They bite too. Bagworms like your shed, Dick says cryptically, standing by my miniature metal barn. I follow his finger and find a half-inch tube made from bits of leaf. It's stuck at one end to the steel wall. I notice a dozen more. Like caddis flies that make underwater homes of grit, these insects haul around houses of organic junk, eventually parking to emerge as mini-moths, Dick says. I'm kind of embarrassed to admit I've occasionally found them on my walls indoors and wondered what they were. I have an open-door policy in the summer, and this year everything from bumblebees to a chipmunk will amble through my house. Chuck Lubelchick is hunched inside the shed, delighting in spiders. One lady's eggs have just hatched, and an astronomical number of specks are spreading from the papery sack. Small wasp nests hang in the corners. We all converge at the raspberry mulch in the heat of noon. Dick sprawls on his stomach, peels back some mulch, and plows a furrow with his finger. Things appear. Rove beetle, Chuck Peters says, handing it to Dick, who's collecting them for research. Something green lands on Dick's hand. There's a neat bug, he says, and Chuck Peters raises his eyebrows at me. When Dick says bug, he means bug, or order Hemiptera. Many insects have two sets of wings. In true bugs, part or all of the forewings are hardened into a flattish, oval shell. Bugs also suck their food through four straws that constitute a mouth. Most drill into plants, but the bed bug is a human specialist. Mosquitoes, by contrast, are flies. A copper-shiny beetle bashes across the dirt like a dinosaur. Dick tells me it eats earthworms. This is the Huck Finn approach to collecting, Chuck Peters observes. You find a place where you're happy, and you flip over a bit of stuff and watch things scurry across. And it looks like so much fun, Chuck Lubelchick adds, that people come and join you. Huck and company move on to examine an apple tree. Carpenter ant, Dick says, pointing. His glasses are sliding in sweat. Spider, Psosid. The last is a tiny, moth-like guy sitting motionless in the topography of bark. They feed on fungi. Chuck Peters sees a stealth bomber-shaped fly he wants for his personal collection and deploys his aspirator. This is a stoppered bottle with two tubes going through the cork. He aims one tube at the fly and inhales sharply on the other tube. The fly lands in the bottle. A screen over the sucking tube prevents the fly from proceeding to Chuck's mouth. Chuck's students delight in getting their hands on his aspirator and secretly removing the screen. Eventually, the sun becomes unbearable, even for animals who cool their surfaces with sweat. Chuck Peters folds his equipment. He has strung a tarp like a sail between two bushes. While we bug hunted, a dozen flies, beetles, and bugs have flown into it, rolled down, and splashed into a plastic half-pipe filled with soapy water. Booty. Chuck has also taken a kite-like span of nylon and gone beating the bushes with a stick. Bounteous bugs tumbled out of hiding and landed on the kite. This, too, folds to go in his car. The bug hunters then buzz away. The bugs and I are left with the sun. Late summer is always a tough time for creepy crawlies. Although they're solidly classified as cold-blooded animals, many of them do generate their own heat. Bumblebees shiver to heat up their flying muscles on a cold morning. Dragonflies shiver as they perch, to stay revved and ready to whirr after a passing mosquito. Staying cool is a problem, especially for flying insects whose muscles produce waste heat. So midsummer is hard on bugs. On people, too. Now that I know how to look for bugs, I'll undertake a more methodical survey of my insect nation. On a cooler day. On a gentler morning, I'm circling the yard when I catch a whiff of nutmeg and follow it to a small hedge of bamboo, also known as Japanese knotweed, on my north fence. sprays of the tiny white flowers are opening on the hedge. Like other plants that rely on animals to pollinate them, bamboo releases perfume to attract attention. The bamboo may also turn up the temperature of its tissues, a newly discovered ability among plants which may help to lure insects. A savvy insect knows that a reward, nectar, nutritious pollen, or a free warm-up, awaits anyone willing to transfer a few grains of pollen from one blossom to another. Looking at the bamboo today, you wouldn't guess that there's a pollinator crisis upon the land, but it's a fact. Some wild plants aren't able to recruit the assistance they need and go unfertilized. The cause is largely chemical. Pesticides that soak modern lawns, gardens, and farms aren't all discriminating about what they kill. Bees, bugs, flies, and butterflies die along with the Japanese beetles and the cutworms. Since some plants have evolved to be picky about their pollinator, the loss of a particular insect can frustrate a plant's efforts to reproduce. My favorite example of this problem unfolded when French colonists took Mexican vanilla plants to Réunion off the coast of Africa. No native insect would deign to visit the new orchid, however, and the Mexican bee, who provided the service at home, refused to travel. So all vanilla grown outside of Central America, and most of it grown in Central America for that matter, is pollinated by people, by hand, one flower at a time. The bamboo is having no such trouble, though it's not native to North America. Its spicy summons have gone out, and a blur of insects has assembled. On my side of the hedge, I count a dozen honeybees and nearly twice that many bumblebees. White-faced wasps and an orange and black wasp with a glittering gold face all paw through the flowers. A yellow jacket, in a nectar frenzy, lands on my wrist and bites me. Doesn't sting as a rational yellow jacket would, but bites as a nectar-crazed one evidently will. Flies of all shapes and sizes work through the blossoms. Whether they're harvesting nectar, pollen, or other insects, I can't tell. I pick a few of the flowers and take them to the microscope on the deck. I can't see any pollen, but the flowers are slick with nectar, and there are, by my quick calculation, more than 2 million individual blooms in this small hedge. The bamboo wilderness on the other side of the yard must hold hundreds of millions more. That's a lot of calories. The bamboo festival lasts for days. The bees are so intent on harvesting nectar that I can pat them as they work. I can ruffle the yellow fur on a bumble's thorax. I can stroke the black corduroy of her abdomen. The honeys are busier and more intimidating, but they're equally patable. That busyness of the honeybees is part of the pollination problem. When Europeans brought hives of these sugar makers to the Americas, the honeys made a beeline for the niche occupied by native bumblebees. They visited the same flowers, they gathered the same nectar, and they did it more efficiently. Honeybees excel at finding thick concentrations of the sweetest flowers. And thanks in part to the bee boogie they perform back in the hive, they excel at leading masses of their sisters back to suck a flower patch dry. As a result, wherever honeybees roam, bumblebees can't afford to raise as many new queens as they used to. In his classic book, Bumblebee Economics, zoologist Bernd Heinrich calculates an unseen cost for the pint of honey in my cupboard. Had the nectar that went into that honey been collected by native bumblebees instead of European honeybees, it would have supported 436 more reproductives, the young males and queenlets who go forth in autumn to start new bumble families. Just as native bees are losing nectar, native plants are losing native bees. In a study of the pink lady's slipper, an orchid that grows in the woods around here, scientists found that only 2% of the flowers in the study lured a bumblebee and achieved pollination. the fertility of more than half the plants subjected to similar studies has proven to be limited not by poor soil or marauding caterpillars, but by a shortage of pollinators. If honeybees have elbowed aside the bumblebees, why can't those honeybees step in and provide the pollination service? One reason is related to the vanilla story. Some complicated flowers can be penetrated only by a specialized insect or bird. If that specialist becomes rare, the flower is out of luck. The other reason is that after the imported honeys hammered the native pollinator population, their own population crashed. Two plagues of blood-sucking mites slew huge numbers of honeybee colonies, perhaps including nearly all the feral families. Beekeepers have lost most of their domestic colonies, too. If the native pollinators can overcome pesticides and the paving of their habitat, bumble queens raise their families underground, perhaps now is their chance to reclaim their niche. In my bamboo hedge, though, the pollination system grows more complex by the day. One day, two scarlet dragonflies arrive to perch in the bamboo and wait for the right size meal to wing by. The dragonflies are as spleeny as hummingbirds and spend more time arguing than hunting. A day later, a little gray bird, a least flycatcher, takes up residence in a nearby apple tree. He swoops into the humming airspace to snatch an insect, then returns to his branch. When the bamboo flowers turn brown after 10 days, the birds and dragonflies will have been fed. The parasitic wasps and flies may have slapped an egg or two onto a host, and the bamboo will be pollinated. Those insects who have harvested sufficient nectar and pollen will plow their resources into a new generation. Underground, maybe even under my deck, a bumblebee will top up her mud honeypots and fatten her brood. The next stop on my survey provides a lesson in insect sex. Although insects are wild animals, they're not shy about using the microhabitats right against my house, even for their most intimate activities. One afternoon, I hear a cricket gritching inside the deck. I steal toward the sound, expecting it to stop. For once, it doesn't. This is a cricket with something even more important than safety on his mind. This is a cricket in love. I sit slowly on the steps and watch a cricket version of the Trojan War rage at my feet. Paris, I presume, is standing atop one of the rocks lining the garden. He flicks his right wing over his left, scraping the tines of a little comb over a little bar. Crick, crick, crick. A whole herd of shiny black helens with tubular ovipositors at their posterior ends muddle around in the garden, eating fallen tomatoes and other detritus. Across the plains of the garden comes Menelaus. He hardly slows as he passes the helens. At the base of Paris's rock, he issues a mighty crick. Paris tumbles down to face him. The warriors glare at each other, and then they lurch forward, propelled on their mighty legs. Their black heads collide, and they grapple with their forelegs. Each tries to heave the other backward. Even as they heave, they crick. Again and again they butt and heave until Menelaus backs away and quits the field. Paris will hold Troy for another day. He surveys the spoils of war. Doing a bucking dance, he approaches a helen. She is intent on an old tomato. Another helen burrows under a scrap of clear plastic that has settled near the chives. He cricks behind a third lady, then taps her wing with his antenna. She doesn't leave, so he walks onto her back. But her ovipositor is buried in the dirt, and she's laying eggs. He walks off over her head. From under the deck, another male cricks at half volume. I wonder if he's trying to attract a girl while reducing the odds of getting his cricket teeth kicked in by Paris. Paris finally returns to his rock, followed by a helen. After some coyness at the entrance to a tiny grass cave beside the rock, she enters, and he hops down after her. They reemerge shortly, and the damsel returns to the garden. Across the plains comes another challenger. Crickets rarely hop, I notice. They plod along like the rest of us. The new warrior walks straight to Paris at the cave entrance, but turns tail when Paris comes out bucking. I pull this guy out of the grass and set him on my knee. He's a handsome devil with shiny black eyes and long, sensitive antennae. He's missing one of his jumping legs, which might explain his aversion to conflict. He sits in the sun for 5 minutes, then hops down. 5 males now mill among the females. Too many for Paris to fight, but most of the Helens are already laying eggs anyway, loosening the dirt with their forelegs and poking their ovipositors into the soil. All of these heroes will die with the first hard frost. Then, if I do no destructive gardening, micro-crickets will emerge in the spring. They'll molt as many as a dozen times before they're mature, and a new generation will sport on the plains of Troy. The cricket's approach to sex is so straightforward as to be aberrant in the insect world. At the other end of the spectrum are the springtails. Springtails are mini-insects who resemble, if anything, elongated fleas. But they're tiny. Nearly 700 species inhabit North America, but most people know them only as spots of dirt that move. According to my rough estimate, I could be stepping on a few hundred each time I set foot on the lawn. In addition to the usual 6 legs, many springtails feature a tail that can snap them into the air. They also feature notable mating methods. In one species, the male approaches his much larger lady and grips her by the antennae. He deposits a droplet of sperm on the ground, then drags his date onto it. In another species, residents of trees, the male deposits a corral of sperm droplets, each upon a stalk, around his quarry. When she exits the corral, she is bound to collide with a droplet, inseminating herself. And these are the more romantic species of springtails. Most of the males leave their sperm stalks any old place for any old girl to stumble across. Scientists have watched males tend these sperm gardens in which they appear to eat their stale deposits and plant fresh ones. Studying the sex lives of insects, I finally decipher the mystery of looped dragonflies. Many times I've witnessed 2 dragonflies locked together in a loop, his tail grasping her head and her tail curled under herself and locked onto his chest. Yes, they're mating. At some point in his evolution, the male dragonfly decided that the wisest thing to do with his sperm was to bend his tail forward and deposit it in a reservoir on his chest. Now to collect it, the female has to maneuver her own tail up to his chest. In some cases, it takes an hour to complete the transfer. How this sort of thing evolves, what sort of genetic mutations culminates in such an arrangement, is one of the 10 million questions that keep evolutionary biologists awake at night. And that's all we have time for on this edition of The Maine Reader. We're reading Suburban Safari, A Year on the Lawn by Hannah Holmes. This is The Maine Reader on Maine Airs. My name is Randy LaBarre. Thank you for listening.